Thank you. So my presentation also is on colorectal cancer screening. And I have no conflicts of interest or anything that I need to disclose. Okay, so Dr. Zapka very nicely set up this talk. She was describing underuse of colorectal cancer screening discussions by primary care physicians. I'm going to talk in a more general sense about underuse of colorectal cancer screening tests in the U.S. population. I also have a couple of slides that I'm going to show about use of colorectal cancer screening tests by primary care physicians. This is from some of the survey data that we've been talking about. And then the last part of the talk is I'm going to describe some of the strategies that were identified during the NIH State of the Science Conference on Enhancing Use and Quality of Colorectal Cancer Screening, which was held earlier this year. So let me start with the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force recommendations for colorectal cancer screening. And these are the most current recommendations of the task force. These were released about 2 years ago. So for adults aged 50 to 75 years, the task force gives its strongest recommendation to screening with high sensitivity FOBT on an annual basis, sigmoidoscopy every 5 years, or colonoscopy every 10 years. Then for adults in the 76 to 85 year age group, the recommendation is actually not to screen routinely. And so what the task force has said is that this really should be a topic of discussion between patients and physicians as to whether and how frequently screening ought to be done. And then for adults older than 85, the recommendation is to not screen because it's believed based on current evidence that the harms associated with screening might actually outweigh any benefits. And then for all populations, the task force does not at present recommend screening with CT colonography or with fecal DNA testing because the evidence in support of these newer technologies is considered to be insufficient. So I'm going to show some data in the next few slides. Wanted to just give you a picture of what is going on with colorectal cancer screening in the U.S. Population. So these are data from the National Health and Immunity Survey. It's trend data from 2000 through 2008. And it's for the Preventive Services Task Force's target population of adults aged 50 to 75. And so what you can see is, or what I have here, it's the proportion of adults who've had a home FOBT in the past year, who've had a sigmoidoscopy in the past 5 years, a colonoscopy in the past 10 years, or are up to date with screening, which means having had any of these tests within the recommended time intervals. And so what you can see in this graph is that use of home FOBT and sigmoidoscopy is low and declining. You can see the significant increase in colonoscopy over this 8 year period of time. And then you can also see that we are increasing in use of colorectal cancer screening overall from 39% in 2000 to 55% in 2008. But still, as of 2008, 45% of the target population was not current with recommended colorectal cancer screening, and that's about 35 million people. So I wanted to give some examples of where we really see some underuse. So this shows test use by four racial ethnic groups: non-Hispanic whites, non-Hispanic blacks, Asians, and Hispanics. The patterns are actually very similar for the four groups. But if you look over to the far right of the graph for the combined FOBT and endoscopy, or the up-to-date category, in particular, test use is quite low for Hispanics. In 2008, 39% of Hispanics in the U.S. were up-to-date with screening, as compared to 57% of non-Hispanic whites. This shows test use according to health insurance categories. This is for the the adult population aged 50 to 64, which is the non-age-eligible, or the population that's not age-eligible for Medicare. So, and it's for four different insurance groups: private HMO, private non-HMO, public, which means having either Medicaid or Medicare coverage, and then the last group is the uninsured. And what's really striking here is just how low the test use rates are for the uninsured. So, let me see if I can get this to, work. It's showing. Okay. So for the uninsured in 2008, 20% were up to date with screening, as compared to about, no, it's not working. Okay. Compared with about 55% of the population that had private health insurance coverage. So that's a pretty large gap between those groups. People who do not have a usual source of health care have particularly low rates of colorectal cancer test use or screening, and that's evident here in this graph. So you can see over here on the far right, so in 2008, those with no usual source of health care, this is about 16%. Were up to date with screening, as compared to 57% of the population that reported that they did in fact have a usual source of health care. And then there's a definite gradient in terms of how frequently people go to the go to see the doctor. So for people who reported having no physician visits in the past year, again, this is a group where we see particularly low rates of test use. And so, for example, in 2008, this was about 18% of this group was up to date, compared with 62% of those who had two or more physician visits in the past year. So I wanted to just show, I've got two slides of some primary care physician data. So national guidelines recommend against using in-office FOBT or FOBT that's done via a digital rectal exam. And so something that we've been monitoring with our physician survey data for some period of time is primary care physician self-reported methods for conducting FOBT. And this is actually from some work that was led by Miriam Nadel of the CDC. And so in 2000 and in 2007, about a quarter of primary care physicians indicated that they were exclusively using home FOBT test kits when they were recommending FOBT to their patients. In 2007, about 22% were exclusively using in-office FOBT, and then about 53% reported that they were actually using both. And this is something that is of concern because the in-office test is really considered to be not a very effective means of accomplishing screening. This is from another study. This was led by Robin Yabroff of the NCI to look at primary care physicians and the extent to which their colorectal cancer screening recommendations are guideline consistent. And so this was using data from two of our nationally representative provider surveys. And so what this slide shows is the proportion of primary care physicians who had colorectal cancer screening recommendations that across the test modalities that they were recommending, that they were entirely guideline consistent, that were somewhat guideline consistent, and that were not guideline consistent for any of the tests that they were recommending. And so what this shows is that In 2000, about 9% of PCPs had recommendations that were entirely guideline consistent. That increased to 19%. And then the proportion for whom their recommendations were not guideline consistent, it was 51% in 2000 and went down to 40%. So this does show some improvement in the guideline consistency of PCP's recommendations, and it does seem that primary care doctors are paying more attention to guidelines. So I'm going to turn now to talking about the NIH State of the Science Conference on Enhancing Use and Quality of Colorectal Cancer Screening, which was held earlier this year. And this was an effort to provide a comprehensive assessment of how colorectal cancer screening is implemented, monitored, and evaluated for average risk populations in the U.S. And a second objective was to identify knowledge and system gaps that need to be addressed in order to increase appropriate use of screening. There is a very structured and rigorous format that's used in a State of the Science conference. This conference was co-sponsored by the NCI and by the NIH Office of Medical Applications of Research. So there was a very detailed evidence review that was commissioned by the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, presentations by 22 subject matter experts. There were periods of public discussion that were interspersed throughout the three-day conference. And then the evidence review was examined by a 13-member independent panel. So this panel, these are non-federal, non-advocacy individuals who are selected for the panel. And the conference was guided by a set of content questions. So what we were looking at were recent trends in use and quality, the factors that influence colorectal cancer screening, effective strategies for increasing appropriate use, what are the capacities or resources for delivering colorectal cancer screening at the population level, and then effective approaches for monitoring use and quality. And then we also had a set of future research needs which were identified. There are several reports that came out of this, and they're actually available on the websites that I've listed here. There also were two articles that were published earlier this year in the Annals of Internal Medicine, one from the independent panel and the other from the evidence review. And in the back of the room, we also have the actual panel statement. This just came from the printer a couple of weeks ago, and I brought a stack of these, so they're in the back. And please take one on your way out. So I want to spend just my remaining time talking about some of the EPC and panel findings and recommendations. So in terms of factors influencing use of colorectal cancer screening, some of the things that we just don't know enough about. So what are the factors that lead physicians to recommend or patients to choose one colorectal cancer screening test over another? It's just not something that has been studied in a lot of detail. How patient preferences influence informed and shared decision making about test choice, how physician recommendations to the patient influence both test choice and adherence to guidelines, and then what are some of the ways to eliminate financial barriers and racial, ethnic, socioeconomic, and geographic disparities? And then another area that has been relatively understudied is how the organization of the practice influences whether and how patients are screened. There are several things that we know that are effective in increasing colorectal cancer screening rates. So at the patient level, eliminating structural barriers, and this can include things like direct mailing of FOBT cards, one-on-one interactions between patients and providers. Patient reminders have been shown to be very effective. And then system level interventions involving non-physician staff in screening delivery, and then also some of the strategies to help patients keep appointments, and this includes patient navigators. So organized approaches to substitute to screening have been shown to be helpful. But there also are several research and implementation needs. So there are some things that we just don't know whether these strategies are effective. Community-based interventions, mass media messaging, and decision-making tools that incorporate patient preferences. And then whether financial incentives, either directed to patients or to physicians, whether those work really has not been studied. And then the effectiveness of colorectal cancer screening interventions across racial, ethnic, socioeconomic, and geographic groups. So we know that some interventions are effective, but whether they're equally effective across diverse groups is not known. And then finally, the sustainability of successful interventions over time. This is important because screening is not a one-time event. It's something that needs to happen periodically. The capacity area is something about which we really don't have a lot of good information. There is some work that's been done. Some of it was led by Laura Seeth at the CDC, but the panel really commented on the paucity of good data and the need to generate new data so that we can get more precise estimates of current and projected endoscopic capacity, for example, what projected demand might be. No one's really looked at the impact of overuse and misuse on capacity estimates. There's this assumption that the problems are all related to underuse of screening, but there is also overuse and misuse that is occurring. And then while you can look at capacity from a national standpoint, you're really talking about resources that have to be deployed at a local level. And so it also needs to be studied in local environments and communities. In terms of monitoring, well, one of the statements of the panel was that we don't have a comprehensive system in the U.S. That effectively monitors use or quality of colorectal cancer screening across a range of populations and for all of the approved modalities. So there's data out there that addresses use or quality, but not both, and really not comprehensively. So some of the recommendations here were really specific to some of the things that need to be put in place in order to develop that comprehensive monitoring infrastructure. So in summary, what we have seen is that colorectal cancer screening rates for adults in the age group that is targeted by the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force have increased. I mean, we have seen progress. So the most current data show that about 55% of adults in this population are current with screening, but there's still quite a bit of work that needs to be done because of the 45% that is not current with screening. And rates are considerably low for particular population groups, the uninsured, people who lack a usual source of health care, and people who didn't have physician visits in the past year. With the implementation, hopefully, of health reform legislation, hopefully, you know, we will see some improvement in the coming years. There also are some outstanding quality issues in primary care physicians' use of colorectal cancer screening. We have seen through some of our monitoring data little change in use of in-office FOBT. And although there's been some improvement for many primary care physicians, their recommendations for colorectal cancer screening are not guideline consistent. Where they're not, they tend to recommend starting screening at earlier ages than what guidelines would indicate, or at intervals that are too frequent. And both of those would actually be examples of over-recommending or over-screening. And then lastly, implementing the NIH State of the Science Conference panel recommendations should move us in the direction of enhancing guideline appropriate use of colorectal cancer screening in the U.S. And I think this is a really excellent report, very comprehensive. A lot of time and thought went into this, and would encourage you to pick up a copy in the back. Also, the entire conference was webcast. So if you go to the OMAR website, if you weren't in attendance at the conference, you can actually just sit at your desk and watch all 2.5 days worth of it. So thank you.
Hey, I'd like to thank all the panelists for their informative presentations and telling us some of what we know about cancer screening guidelines and then presenting some research questions for the future. So we'll have all the presenters up here and the audience, please raise your questions. Yes, ma'am.
One is a question and the other also partially a question but partially a comment. The first is that I was so surprised to see that the HMO group, that is a private HMO, prevalence of a screening test, including colonoscopy, was not so much better than the uninsured. There was such a huge difference between the private HMO and the private fee-for-service group, I thought, in covering completion of colonoscopy or any screening test. The second thing that I wanted to ask was the issue of the highly variable real impact of FOBT on cancer detection and or prevention is so much downplayed because the operational problems with FOBT are not recognized or emphasized enough by the task forces and so on. What you said about the office-based FOBT, which is one of the a major limitation, and the fact that FOBT itself is about no more than 30% sensitive in finding advanced neoplasia, I sometimes wonder about our emphasis on FOBT, knowing these persisting operational limitations of FOBT, and we still recommend it as a major screening tool.
Yeah, so FOBT is can be a challenge. We do know that there are systems out there where FOBT is done very, very well. Actually, there were a couple of people at the State of Science Conference who presented on those systems. So the Veterans Administration is one example, and over a relatively short period of time, I mean, they have put a whole system of screening in place so that they're achieving screening rates of about 80% now within the VA healthcare system, which I think is really pretty remarkable. And Kaiser Permanente of Northern California is at about 70% level of screening. So it's something where you have got to have tracking and monitoring systems in place in order for it to be effective. But we do have some models in the U.S. where it is done. It is done well. I showed in the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force slide that the recommendation is to use high sensitivity FOBT. So some of these systems of care they're using fecal immunochemical testing. So the tests are actually improving, and I think that that's something that's a message that maybe we can get out to primary care doctors. There is some work on behalf of the National Colorectal Cancer Roundtable. They're developing a white paper on FOBT to try to communicate with primary care doctors about some of the better tests that are available and what you would need in practice if you're using FOBT to do this well.
I just wanted to refer to your first comment about HMOs and to sort of remind us all to be mindful of the concern in the field about the labeling of an HMO, that many managed care organizations call themselves HMOs, but they're not the sort of the stereotypic staff model HMOs with good tracking and good coordination of care. Many of them are more like insurance plans than HMOs.
We have another question.
So a couple of speakers indicated a fairly high compliance rate among providers in recommending a new program or recommending screening in particular for
So the survey, you know, we have to be mindful of how much can be covered in a questionnaire that, you know, needs to be administered at about 15 to 20 minutes time. And so in the primary care physician cancer screening survey, we across the board said that the patient population of interest was asymptomatic and average risk. So we did not get into screening issues related to high-risk populations. Yeah, if that was for the survey across the board, all of the screening types that were included.
So it assumes, therefore, that they know what average risk is based on their already defined
risk. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we let them define average risk, but yeah.
Yeah, just to follow up with that, I think that's a really excellent point that you made.
I can't answer whether it's changing or not. We did include some barriers questions on the survey, and that's a piece of the survey that we haven't yet analyzed. So hopefully within the next couple of months we'll get to that.
In the analysis I reported on, we did look at a couple of the barriers, and one was patients have trouble understanding colorectal cancer information. Patients don't follow up on screening. There was one more. It was the patient perception. Their perceptions of patients wanting the physician to make the decision about the test. And interestingly, the patients don't understand information was related to the frequency of discussion or the number of tests that were discussed. So there were some relationship there, but I don't have the data related to the actual performance.
We have a question right here. I
wanted to talk a little bit about the breast cancer question, because I think that the stuff you said about the science writers trying to solve the problem a little bit, I think they've done a terrible job. But I also think the people reporting from the preventive task force and the Annals of Internal Medicine, they did not describe any of the thinking that really goes into this. If you just dump a bunch of statistics on people, it really creates a great deal of confusion, I think, as to why these things are the way they are, and opens the door to just simply attacking, you know, if you cost, which I think is a major player. I think people who are a little suspicious about guidelines and so forth being used to save money in a period of economic crisis, I think those people are correct, but there's a lot of that. But I don't think that's what the main thing was going on. But if the U.S. Preventive Task Force is going to come out with recommendations and the Annals is going to pick it up and write it all down, and nobody's going to explain that there are slow-growing cancers and fast-growing cancers and ER-positive and BR-positive, these types of things, people can understand this. Patients could understand a lot more about breast cancer, even the simple stuff, and maybe come to terms with some of what's being said. Even the primary care physicians won't talk about this. I think the science writers have much more that they can do. And I'm not sure what the relationship, I'm just sort of frustrated, really, because I think that there should be a much better communication pathway from the NCI, from the task force, from all these people to try to make things seem understandable to people so they're not crazy. I think the breast cancer stuff is definitely out of control. I mean, bevacizumab is this drug that's, you know, now they're all fighting to take a drug that has limited benefit anyway. But it's making everybody, distracting everyone from getting around to actually trying to work with people to understand what the future's going to be. Because if we don't help people understand how these things come about, what the underlying possibilities are to explain differences in opinions and differences in data, if we don't get that across to the public, then when the genetics comes in, even more into play, we're not going to know. For example, if you have breast cancer, if you tell me not to screen anybody for breast cancer anymore, okay, only the people who are at high risk, well, who would those people be? If they have a BRCA or they have any number of other genetic mutations, they might be at risk. We don't look for that now. We're supposed to dump all those people into the whole mass of people. So somebody in there does have a genetic risk. How are we supposed to know who those people are? Someday we're going to know that. But we're not preparing people to understand this stuff, and we're making it extremely obscure. So I would really like to know what you thought when you put that slide up, and how you think we might do better.
Well, first of all, I want to thank you for your comments. I think that they're very thoughtful, and they are right on target with some of the cauldron that's been in the public. I can tell you that the National Cancer Institute over the past 10 years, I think, Helen, has had various science writer workshops to help interpret this very complicated data and to try and figure out what the intersection is with the public and how best to communicate this. One of the goals is not to dumb it down, and this in a way was the unfortunate release that happens when you, in today's media age, where you release a press release and it's Twittered, it's Binged, it's with every group immediately, as well as the other intended population, which is the very heavy science, which is intended for the physicians who are actually going to be delivering the guidelines. We have a long way to go, and I think that the release of these guidelines was but yet another wake-up call for those of us who have to deliver complicated scientific information in a not a dumbed-down way, but in a very clear way, so that the message is not only on target, but considers the tremendous variety of women that you've just talked about. I think that we're doing a good job. I think that we're learning from each of our mistakes. And I think that, you know, the way I presented this model was one way to try and drill down to understand the different societal and psychological filters that have built up around this disease. It is like no other cancer. It's a flashpoint. And it is the communication that's going to help us move forward and to diffuse some of the hot point issues. Does anybody else have anything to add to that? Did I answer? Did I help answer some of your question? Thank you.
Okay. I think a woman agreeing with Hugh.
So I guess we had a very closely related question. It seems like there simultaneously is potentially underuse of mammography and overuse of mammography, same colorectal cancer, and so. In this age of one-line tweets, how does one effectively get that message across, which I think is probably very confusing for the outcomes?
I think it's pretty hard to get it in one line.
It is.
Because it's complicated, and that's the problem. And I think also that we, you know, in many ways building up to this, have oversold what, you know, what I think the slide that Erica showed on, you know, early detection equals prevention. I think there's a lot of, you know, that people have a lot of hopes in screening tests that may not be, you know, reality based. And it's hard. Clearly, we need to do a lot more to try to develop effective communication. We don't have it, but I don't think it's going to be, you know, I don't think it can be summarized in a simple, you know, one-liner.
But just to get back to my other point, I think what we can do a better job of when the press releases go out are to potentially target the different media so that things are not skewed so much and they're not so much out of context. I'm going to ask my colleague, Dr. Edwards, who is a communication specialist, to see if she has anything more to add to this.
I guess I don't want to oversimplify, but one of the issues is with the media now becoming so diversified, and by media I don't just mean the traditional media, print, broadcast or whatnot, but now we are using Twitter and, you know, different things. And we have opportunities to both tailor messages, target messages, and also to do the broadcast. So I think people are still dealing with how do you use all of these tools when what my understanding of the task force recommendation was, it is very much a personal level. So it's not enough just to say we can segment by women of a certain age that may be watching these programs or something like that. So I mean, we're dealing with a conversation that is very much on a personal level, and I don't have a solution for how that happens in terms of delivering a message that says, you need it, you do not, because obviously that's an interaction with the doctor. In terms of getting the one-line answer out there, simplifying it, I agree. I don't think there's a way to do that. I think working with journalists, coming from that background, I don't think they're the enemy. I think it's just two different frames of two different ways to approach what you're trying to do. Sometimes competing interests, but a lot of times I think it's just working with journalists, getting scientists and journalists to speak somewhat of a similar language, and it definitely is a work in progress. But some of the ventures that NCI is doing, CDC, we've had a Knight Foundation program to train journalists. I think we just proceed in this area and then keep having these discussions. So, yes, Dr. Taplin?
We have. Just another question. Another way of looking at what's happened is actually what's happened is a discussion. Mm-hmm. Instead of a straightforward, you will understand this, there's actually been a mature discussion among people, right? I characterize all of it as mature, but there's certainly a discussion. And so I wonder whether in colorectal cancer screening, given the complexity of that, you anticipate the need for that kind of discussion. What kind of outrageous recommendation do you need to make in order to encourage discussion?
This is being recorded, isn't it?
I'm sorry.
We have a lot of noise.
He said.
The question was that because one of the things that's happened in breast cancer is it's actually been discussion. So the mature people have a chance to look at a very ambiguous set of data and talk about it. What is there a parallel in colorectal cancer? Is there a need for a because it's a much more actually complicated issue than breast cancer.
One of the things that I'm going to say is that I talked very early on about the multiple social and psychological influences that have led to the history of why breast cancer is this flashpoint. Colorectal, because of the nature of the disease, has never, and I don't think it will ever reach the same level of just active responses. And I think also because of the complexity of the testing procedures. You know, I go back to the fact that, you know, that one slide that I have where mammography in many ways was oversold to women, you know. And I think when you have multiple tests, it's more confusing. It's far more confusing. I mean, that's a superficial answer, but I don't think we're heading down that direction.
Well, and I also think that one of the challenges in colorectal cancer screening is we have guidelines that have, you know, laid out a menu of options, but we know that in a lot of practices that menu is not being presented to patients, and that a lot of patients don't realize that there are other ways of being screened. So there have been studies done of patients who have not followed up on a recommendation to get a screening colonoscopy, and many of those patients have had a number of barriers, some very definite reasons as to why they didn't want to do colonoscopy, but they also didn't know that there was something else that they could have done. So I think that, you know, one of the things that we have to try to figure out is in that discussion, you know, how to bring back into the discussion that there are options available, and there are attitudes among, you know, some physicians that there's a gold standard test, and that gold standard is colonoscopy. And so there are some provider attitudes that I think are going to have to be countermanded in some way.
I think Carrie made several important points, but I just also wanted to emphasize that our culture of delivering medical care is going to make that discussion even more difficult. We're technology dedicated culture. And so, yes, while some people don't want a colonoscopy, but they're never told of something else, some people want the colonoscopy and, in fact, have too many of them. And I think one of the difficulties of this discussion of the public is dealing with financial incentives of specialists, whether it's mammography or gastroenterology. We as scientists don't get engaged in those studies. And yet, if you look at Medicare data, for instance, there's now data coming out that shows we're getting too much colonoscopy in certain patients. When I hear gastroenterologists joking in the elevator that a found adenoma is money in the bank, I'm sorry, I get cynical. And so that there, again, it's a political layered issue that we've got to be more forthright with, and I hope the media catches on to that side of things as well.
I'm sorry, I know there are lingering questions. We've reached the end of our hour, and clearly the kitchen staff wants to get in here. But I would, I don't want to speak for these women, but I imagine they would be open to questions as they leave if you want to catch them. So we thank you for attending and for your thoughtful questions and participation. Thanks.